Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. I've very much enjoyed all my previous visits to PITP, and I very much look forward to a very successful workshop this time. So, in my talk today, I'll describe experimental studies we've done on the spin dynamics in the frustrated pyrochlore material, ytterbium titanate. The main motivation for exploring this material is a very puzzling feature that even though there is long-range magnetic ordering at low temperatures in some canted ferromagnetic order, the spin waves are nowhere to be seen. And in fact, experiments reveal a very broad continuum that dominates over a wide energy range and over wide ranges in Brillouin zone. However, if one applies a large enough magnetic field to almost polarize the spins, then sharp magnon modes become clearly visible. So this work has been the main part of the PhD thesis of Jordan Thompson in my group in Oxford. And he also set up from scratch a specific heat setup to do millikelvin temperature measurements in high magnetic field for this project. So he deserves a lot of credit for the high quality of the experimental data I'm going to show. Paul McClarty did all the spin wave calculations and refinement of the Hamiltonian parameters. Our crystal was grown by Prabhakaran in Oxford using a floating zone technique. And the experiments were done at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in the UK, using the LET spectrometer, which is a very high resolution, very high sensitivity, low energy neutron spectrometer. So I will start with a brief introduction to the physics of the pyrochlore lattice and some really canonical examples of frustrated magnetism that's well understood there, and our motivation to explore ytterbium titanate as a potential candidate for quantum spin dynamics on this lattice. And I'm going to first start with measurements in very high magnetic field where spins are polarized by the applied magnetic field. But this is a well understood limit, and I'm going to start from there and parameterize the Hamiltonian, and then show you that even in this very high field limit, quantum fluctuations are still present, and we see them directly experimentally via two magnon excitations. So then I'm going to follow the excitations coming down in field and see how quantum fluctuations progressively become stronger and several anomalous features appear in the spin dynamics. And then I'm also going to show specific heat measurements that were very helpful to be able to draw the phase diagram and understand some of the low energy behavior in applied magnetic field. So the pyrochlore lattice contains a magnetic sublattice of corner shear tetrahedra, and this is host to a very rich behavior in frustrated magnetism. For example, if the magnetic ion is holmium, this has a very strong easy axis and isotropy that forces the spins to point towards the center of, well, in or out of the tetrahedron pointing towards the center. And for ferromagnetic interactions, there's no unique ground state, but the best that one can do is to have two spins in and two spins out. And already at the level of a single tetrahedron, there are six degenerate states. And when this is then extended over the full three-dimensional lattice, one ends up with an extensive degeneracy. So there's finite entropy even at the zero temperature. So the fact that there are so many degenerate states leads to an elastic response in neutron scattering at all wave vectors in the Brillouin zone. So not very distinct from ordered states which have response only at Brackley positions. So in the case of holmium titanate, there's response everywhere. However, because these states are not totally random but have a constraint of two spins in, two spins out, there's structure in the intensity. And in particular, the intensity narrows down to a point, a so-called pinch point, at specific places in reciprocal space. And this is directly seen experimentally. Now, this is the ground state. However, the excited states probably have even richer physics, in the sense that if we now take one spin and flip it, then we've broken this rule of two in, two out in these two neighboring tetrahedra. So one of them has three spins in and one out, and the other one has three spins the other way. So, however, if we now go to a neighboring tetrahedron and flip another spin, we can restore the two in, two out rule for this one, but essentially move the defect into this other tetrahedron at no energy cost. So, of course, this is just at the level of doing a caricature of spins flip, but fundamentally, this is an example of fractionalization in a three-dimensional magnet, where we locally flip a spin, but we create two objects that can move separately from one another. And in some mathematical theory, these are really map onto magnetic monopoles that would live into this flat band up here in the presence of just Ising interactions. So even more interesting physics happens if one adds some weak perturbations on top of the classical model in the form of some transverse exchanges that would start flipping some of the spins. And the prediction is that the degeneracy in this ground state manifold will be lifted to stabilize a so-called quantum spinized state with photon excitations that start from the pinch points and also some optical mode. All of these basically remembering the original degeneracy into spinized state. And then here, at finite energy, one would expect to have propagating magnetic monopoles. So this is at the level now where we just have Ising exchanges between the spins and some small transverse couplings. Now, the pyrocore lattice actually can show much richer physics if we go away from this special point and looking just at the exchange bond between two neighboring sites, symmetry constraints out of all the nine terms, only four terms become independent. And in this four-parameter space, if one then one has to deal with three ratios, and if we pick a plane, then this is an illustration of some ordered phases that can come about. For example, this is accounted for a magnetic phase. This is a phase where spins are at 90 degrees and rotate in a certain sense, the so-called Palmer-Chalker phase. And the red and the yellow are phases where the spins rotate in the XY plane perpendicular to the directions that go towards the center of the tetrahedron, with some order by disorder selecting which particular type. And various materials are put in the phase diagram. Some are close to boundaries, some are deep inside these phases. But the important thing to realize is that all of these materials have an intrinsic quantum Hamiltonian because they're far away from the Ising limit. So it's interesting to explore the quantum dynamics, even though the systems may be ordered or with strongly enhanced fluctuations, if they're close to the boundaries. So ytterbium titanate has been explored by a number of groups already. And as I mentioned at the start of the talk, what's been seen experimentally is that in zero field, there's very broad continuum with no indication of sharp modes. However, at high enough fields, 5 tesla here, then sharp modes become visible. So a key question here that you might ask is, how do you go between these two limits, which really seem to be very different? How do magnons disappear coming from high field? How do they transform into this broad diffuse scattering? At a sort of more conceptual level, if the broad scattering here arises from quantum fluctuations, how do these fluctuations evolve as a function of field? Are they manifested also at high field? Is there a critical field below which they are completely quenched, or is it a gradual evolution? So these are really issues that can be solved experimentally in great detail. More conceptually, can one understand the origin of this broad scattering continuum here? What is the physical picture of the excitations that lead to this continuum?
And 5 tesla compared to saturation field is what?
So at 5, so because here there's no spin conservation and you don't have rotational symmetry for any field direction, saturation is reached asymptotically. Uh-huh. So there isn't a sharp transition to a true plateau phase, but you only reach it asymptotically. So 7 tesla is sort of close to the 95% limit. This is high enough, I'll show later on.
Sorry, is it all polarized neutron scattering?
So,
Because we're looking at the zone center, no?
Can I explain that?
Sure.
What's known already is that cooling down from high temperatures, here's a picture of the specific heat, there is a broad maximum around about 2 Kelvin or so, indicating some development of short-range order. And then, at much lower temperatures, around 200 millikelv, then there is a very sharp peak in specific heat. And this is associated with a first-order transition to a phase where spins have spontaneous polarization along one of the cubic axes, with some canting that's dictated by the relationship between this ferromagnetic polarization and the local threefold axis 111. So here are polarized neutron scattering measurements to show a top-up of intensity. This is already subtracted. The structural peak that grows as a function of cooling below this peak in specific heat. And here are some powder neutron measurements to show top-up of intensity that's associated with this canted ferromagnetic phase.
This is not in field or in?
This is all in zero field.
Zero field. So all that scattering is still happening in this phase, or is that?
It's here, at millikelvins in zero field, when the spins show this order.
What is the magnitude of the spin?
So we're dealing with the Cramer's ion, where the crystal fields have split the degeneracy down to a Cramer's doublet. So you can treat it as an effective spin and a half, but it will be, the true crystal field wave functions will be quite anisotropic and quite complicated. I will come back to that a bit later. So here's a picture of our single crystal. One I should like to mention that one has to be quite careful with the crystal growth in order to get a sufficiently homogeneous sample, because some of the previous studies showed that the position of the peak can actually be very, very sensitive on the growth conditions, and some samples don't show a transition altogether. So the blue data here is our own data on a piece that was cut from the top of this crystal that was used for neutron scattering and shows a single sharp peak that we attribute to this transition to the canted ferromagnetic phase. And these are some previous measurements from another group on another single crystal to show that, if anything, our crystal is even better. But more recently, actually, it's been possible to push this even slightly higher. So the most recent record is in this paper out here. But we believe that we're sufficiently close to the high purity limit to actually see the representative behavior.
What is actually the broad peak?
Oh, the broad peak is 3 Kelvin out here.
Oh, okay. It's just not in this case, but you still see.
Yeah, it's outside our measurement window. We really wanted to focus on sort of millikelvin type physics. where the ordering happens. So here is the magnetization curve. The green line is data at 90 millikelvin, and the blue data is our own data around about 2 Kelvin. And you see the magnetization grows and only reaches saturation asymptotically. So if we start with measurements at 7 Tesla, which is quite close to full polarization, although that's only reached asymptotically, so what we see experimentally in inelastic neutron scattering is a spectrum of sharp modes. For example, if you look here at 5 Tesla, there are clearly 4 modes, 1, 2, 3, and the fourth one that's almost flat up here. And these 4 modes are associated with spin flips that actually hop on the 4 sublattices of the pyrochore lattice. So the pyrochore lattice is really an FCC lattices of tetrahedra, and each tetrahedra has 4 corners, so one expects to have 4 bands. And upon lowering field, what we see is that this spectrum of 4 bands just comes down in energy due to decreasing Zeeman energy. So this is fully consistent with previous measurements done for another field direction, which is in the basal plane here, a diagonal direction, minus 1, 1, 0. I should mention that knowing that the magnetic structure is really has ferromagnetic polarization along the cubic axis, our strategy in the experiment was to use the field along a cubic axis. And this has several advantages. First of all, we ensure that if we cool in field, we have a single magnetic domain. So we can interpret all the results as coming from a well-defined unique ground state. There's no averaging between 6 domains. And this is important because if one has anisotropic exchange couplings, then if the spins are polarized along Z, then the dispersion in the AB plane can have some form. But if the spins are polarized along X, the same plane can have a different dispersion. And by averaging 6 of those domains, you can easily get ruling. So we specifically wanted to have a single magnetic domain to do a controlled experiment to rule out that scenario. Also, the phase diagram I'll show is much simpler in this case. So, as I mentioned before, in the pyrochore lattice, all the bonds are equivalent, and symmetry constrains that there are 4 terms in the full exchange matrix. And the convention is to express these 4 terms in terms of a local coordinate system where the z-axis points towards the center of the tetrahedron. And in that case, the exchange Hamiltonian has an Ising part and then 3 other transverse parts. Also, we have a g-tensor that's not isotropic because we have a local threefold axis here. So there's a g along the unique axis and transverse. So the Hamiltonian has 6 parameters in total. And the challenge experimentally is then to use experimental data such as this with dispersion relations along many different directions and try to identify the values of the exchange couplings. So this is actually a very challenging problem because the fact that there's no spin rotational invariance, it means that all the terms are strongly coupled with one another. So if we start, say, at very high field, no interactions, then the moment directions are going to be dictated by minimizing the g-tensor, which is going to be a direction that's actually in between the parallel and perpendicular, so not a special direction. Then if we switch on exchange, spins are going to cant a little bit away from this direction. And then we project the Hamiltonian onto the new quantization axis. So imagine that I change one of the g-tensor parameters or one of the exchange terms. Then the canting angle will be ever so slightly different, the projection will be different, and the dispersions will change. So everything is strongly coupled together, and one needs a very extensive data set of many qualitatively different pieces of information. So in order to be confident about finding a unique solution. We've not only used our own experimental data set, where we've measured the dispersion along many directions, I mean 17 directions in reciprocal space, and we've extracted over 500 dispersion points, but we also used previous experimental data sets for a different field direction where the projection of the G tensor is different. And then we also use magnetization data at saturation because that also puts an absolute scale on the average G factor. So one important point to appreciate is that at very high fields, G longitudinal and the Ising term are very strongly coupled together because both of them act as an effective mean field. So really one needs to have all of these different pieces of information to be able to uniquely identify the Hamilton. So using all of this experimental information, here, so we've done a fit where we've refined all of the six parameters. And this is, so this red line is the calculated magnetization at the mean field level, so that this value is well reproduced. And here I'm showing very many dispersion points where this is the experimental energy and this is the calculated energy. And each data point actually has information about the HKL position, the energy, whether it's mode 1, 2, or 3, or 4, and which field direction. So this is a this has a lot of rich information that constrains the Hamiltonian. Yes?
And theoretical calculations were done quasi-classically or?
Sure.
So it's just linear.
So just at the level of Forstein-Primakov, assuming that, you know, linear order. That's right.
Sorry, I'm just confused. So at zero field, there is a finite magnetization, right? You said it.
Sure.
So is this just a one leg of the hysteresis that you're showing? No, yeah, because the data seems to go
so
back to zero. Where
90 millikelvin is the green data that starts from there, really.
Ah, okay, got it. Okay.
So the blue data is 1.9 kelvin.
So that's above the transition.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right. Right, so this is the method that we've used to refine the Hamiltonian. And these are the parameters that we obtained. And compared to previous parameterization using the field along the basal plane diagonal direction, our parameterization is slightly different in the sense that the Ising term, which was predicted to be dominant before, is actually negligible in our parameterization. Whereas the other exchange couplings we agree on, but also the G factors are a bit different in our case than in the previous case, which also assumed a certain ratio for the anisotropy and fixed it. We actually refined this. So just to show you here that you know, this third column is the previous parameterization of this data, and the middle column is our own parameterization. The differences are really at the level of very fine detail and almost indistinguishable from the experimental data. However, now that we have an extensive data set for another field orientation, we think that we can distinguish between these two models. So here are some directions in our experiment where the white points are extracted from doing energy scans.
Let me
so,
ask a question on the previous slide. So now you have the G, your ZZ coupling is not at all the largest one. So
it's
basically
negative.
That means that you are not really starting from the spinized physics and adding some quantum fluctuation, but you are more like in XY or something like this.
I think we're very far away from spinized physics. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
You don't know me. Yeah.
You're saying it's negative, but I see quantum.
Sorry?
You're saying JZZ is negative?
No, it's negligible.
No, negligible. Negligible, okay. Negligible, yeah. So the way to read this is that there's negligible Ising part, and really the dominant term in the Hamiltonian is just one of them, and it's JZ plus minus, or is a term that flips spins. So in this basis is a really quantum Hamiltonian. But I'll describe another basis which I think is also very relevant. Yeah?
These two were in the two different field directions, right?
So these parameters were extracted by assuming a fixed relative ratio and using just this data set, the five panels.
But the field is applied the same direction as in your data set.
Field applied along diagonal minus one mono direction. These parameters were extracted using this data, and in addition, also our own data with field along the O1 axis, and magnetization, and allowing everything to vary. So we've tried to include absolutely every possible data that exists in regions where the theory is controlled and compare it. So this is data with field along 100. So our model parameterization, you see, gives very good agreement with the experimental measurements. All the white dots are on calculated lines where gaps are seen experimentally. Gaps are predicted. Strong modes are strong. Weak modes are weak. That's everywhere in reciprocal space. Whereas with the previous parameterization, there are significant discrepancies in the sense that modes are shifted, and also gaps that are seen experimentally are not reproduced in very many places. So we think this disagreement is actually relevant because it is in the center of mass of the scattering. It's not just a little detail that a weak mode is somewhat shifted, but the strongest mode is shifted. So we think this is relevant. And furthermore, this parameterization explains everything. So these are other directions in reciprocal space where you see the spectrum is very different. Sometimes you see modes touching here. And everywhere where we look, no, the agreement is really exceptionally good, I would say. Everywhere where we look, you know. Strong modes are strong, weak are weak, gaps appear where they should be, and so on. So what we've also done is to pick, say, the two relevant terms that were identified before, the Ising term and the JZ plus minus, and then for each point, refine everybody else and plot the chi-squared. Okay. So our parameterization sits inside this deep minimum here, whereas the previous parameters are here. So that's clearly very far away. It's really distinguishable. Now, furthermore, the refined values for the G-tensor are actually in very good agreement with the most recent crystal field determination. Okay, whereas the previously assumed G-tensor ratio, which was based actually on some misidentified crystal field levels, wouldn't agree with this. Now, furthermore, this parameterization also agrees with some Monte Carlo calculations for the diffuse scattering at finite temperature. And also, the same parameters agree with no adjustable parameters with terahertz data. And the agreement is both in the energies and the polarizations of the mode. So here is terahertz data, where the different colors indicate different polarizations. And our parameterization, just out of the box, explains all of them, whereas the previous parameterization couldn't. So we regard this good agreement with all the data as strong indication that the Hamiltonian really is very close to what we have determined. So here is now a semi-classical phase diagram where, so if you imagine that you've got this four-parameter Hamiltonian, you normalize everything to one of them, so you have three independent ratios, then this is 3D space, and you pick a plane in this 3D space such that you go through the classical spin ice point. Then you also go to the meeting point of all the phases that I showed before, where the Slade ferromagnet, the Palmer-Chalker antiferromagnet, and the other XY antiferromagnets meet. And then the third point is the parameterization for the turbine type net. So these three points fix this plane. Okay? These are some funny directions, but that's what it means. Yeah? It's just to illustrate how far the parameters of this Hamiltonian are for the classical spin ice point. And probably a more relevant description of the physics will be in terms of the proximity to the space boundary between ferromagnetism and actually some XY antiferromagnetism. So,
displayed ferromagnetism, what does that mean?
It's this canted ferromagnet, where there's a polarization on one of the cubic axes, but the moments are titted slightly in relation to the local 111. So the spin ice is contained in here, because if I tilt this angle to be exactly towards the center, I get two in, two out. So that's a spin ice state, but it's a canted ferromagnet at the same time. And in fact, going away from this, along this line, the spin ice degeneracy is maintained at the classical level. The angle remains zero. This color shading is meant to indicate the tilting angle corresponding to the 111 axis. So along all of this line, classical spin ice states are degenerate at the classical level. But of course, the degeneracy is exact here, and quantum fluctuations can lift it here. So maybe spin ice physics, quantum spin ice physics could be relevant in regions close to this whole line, not just this one. I mean, so, but anyway, we're quite far away, I would say, from this point, and much closer to this phase band. So, as you asked me before, so once we identify that the Ising term is very small, is it even relevant to use that basis? And so if we actually go back now to the cubic axes, then here is the exchange matrix that defines the coupling between two nearest neighbors. And if we transform the Hamiltonian into this basis, then we find two large terms. The dominant one here, J2, if you look at this tetrahedron, which is inside this cube, so J2 refers to an Ising coupling along an axis perpendicular to this bond. Okay? So it's along the x-axis. However, if I apply the threefold rotation here, then the x-axis will go into z, and then z will go into y. So I can color the lattice with these different labels, and then I get a three-colored lattice, where at each vertex, I have actually three colors meeting here and three here. So this is precisely the Kitaev model for the pyrochlore lattice. And then the next order term, which is also quite substantial, is also anisotropic and refers to a symmetric coupling of the two spin components in this plane perpendicular to the Ising axis. So yz here and changes. So in this formulation, then we have a ferromagnetic Kitaev and negative so-called gamma term as the minimum model on this lattice. And you can see here that this is very strongly frustrated and is also quantum, because if the spins were, say, along the z-axis, so all the blue bonds are satisfied, then the energy on the red and the green at the classical level is zero. But really, this is a quantum exchange that would flip. So, and then the flipping terms are the same order of magnitude as the Ising term. So really is, the quantum dynamics is very strong. This is not a system that's weakly perturbed from some classical limit by weak dynamics. The dynamics is the big physics. So if I go back now to our original motivation for looking at how the quantum fluctuations evolve, so as I mentioned before, the fact that the magnetization doesn't saturate is due to zero-point fluctuation. And it's clear to see that in this formulation, whenever you apply the field, there isn't rotational invariance. And in this case, one way to think about it is that there are some zero-point fluctuations in the ground state. In a sense, some spins are already flipped. So with neutrons, you can unflip one and flip another one, so you can see two particles scattering. And in fact, if we optimize the experimental setup to look with high sensitivity at high energies, we indeed see a signal that's in the energy range of two magnons. So down here is the energy range for one magnon dispersion, and there's an extra signal here that's multiplied 15 times just to put it on the same scale. And this is strongly field dependent. Here is the scanning energy going up to show here are the one magnon modes. And this is another magnetic signal that actually shifts with magnetic field and is not there at all at low field. And this catching up here actually, as we lower the field, grows in intensity, and the boundaries come down at twice the rate compared to the boundaries of the one magnon. So really, it's two particle scattering. So something quite interesting happens here, where the continuum starts to overlap with the top of the magnon bands. So because the magnons have some bandwidth, and this one comes at twice the rate, it will intersect at some point. Before it intersects, nothing really happens. The modes here remain sharp, just drop in Zeeman energy. But here, the intensity grows. Okay. As you reduce the magnetization, so your zero-point fluctuations increase. And that's manifested in more weight in here, in these guys. So 3 tesla is just above the field where there's a separation. So here is 2 magnons scattering. Here are the 4 modes, 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, we go to 2 tesla. You see, everybody has come down in energy. But number 4 is no longer to be seen. So number 4 has merged with the continuum. It's in here. So if we further lower the field, 1.5 tesla, things move low in energy due to the reducement of Zeeman energy. However, the continuum grows in intensity. And actually, these modes still remain well-defined, but their bandwidth is reduced. And if you go to 1 tesla, then the separation between the modes here is actually half of what it was at 3 tesla. So to visually see that here, you see the separation of modes here is very large, whereas the 1 tesla is almost collapsed.
When there's separation, it's pretty clear that it's 2 magnon continuum. But if there is overlapping, can we even talk about 2 magnon continuum or just continuum of multi-magnon states?
It's a continuum of multi-particle states. I'll come back to that, actually. We're not sure, for example, if this bump up here is due to the lower edge of 3 magnons coming in or some structure factor in the 2 magnon density of states. But certainly these will be interesting issues to explore. But we use this language of 2 magnons. I think it's valid at very high fields.
Sure.
Okay. So I'm just going to use that as a basis and then discuss how much we can, you know, what significance we attribute to that. So I think 2 things are very relevant here. One is that there's a very strong coupling between 1 and 2 spin flips. And then the 1 magnon states already know that the continuum is coming, and they adjust their dispersion. So really, there is coupling between them, even though there is no overlap. So and this suppression of the magnon bandwidth is also relevant, we think, because the magnon hopping is some kinetic energy that the magnons gain from hopping. And so if their background has large quantum fluctuations, you may think that the kinetic energy is not so large. So you suppress the coherent magnon hopping. And that would be manifested experimentally in a reduction of the bandwidth. Now, this reduction is actually quite dramatic. And at 0.75 tesla, it's almost a single mode, as if the excitation no longer hops coherently, but it's more localized. And certainly, we're interested to think more about what the significance of this is. Yes?
So I don't know if I'm following the talk, but my understanding so far is that you're putting forth that the classical spinized description of turbine type in A is not correct. Is that?
That's our conclusion, that we haven't seen any region of parameter space where we need to have that description to explain any experimental feature.
So then, I got something right. So then, does the whole monopole story
you know, absence or presence of monopole evidence, does this, you know, saying that you shouldn't expect does classical spinites, does that explain non-existing evidence of monopoles? Or am I taking your talk to
Okay, I was going to come back to that point a bit later, but so the physics just perturbing around the classical spinites, where there is a large separation of scales between the Ising coupling and the perturbing terms. So that physics is understood, and there are specific predictions for what should happen at the phenomenological level once you apply a field. One would expect to have two monopole bound states that would have a specific way of moving up in field. So I do not think that we've seen any of that. In fact, that is the physics that we wanted to see. That was, you know, the motivation for doing these experiments, to see whether possibly the continuum was associated with that. But my understanding is that those bound states should have appeared in a certain region of field where there is separation between one particles and two particles, and we haven't seen.
So, but nevertheless, your model that you arrive at by fitting lots of all the exhaustive amount of data points to a frustrated model.
It's a frustrated model, but it's somewhere else in parameter space, different from the classical spinites or weak perturbations away. I think it's a completely different Hamiltonian, which, you know, it's interesting, it's not right. And the quantum phase diagram of that in dynamics are not understood. I mean, we're hoping that this extensive phenomenology would help guide the theory. It would be very interesting to do that. But I'm not sure that, you know, it's justified to use just the perturbations around the Ising picture, because we don't see the separation of scales, and there's no evidence for strong JZ. I mean,
Do you think this will apply?
Can I just try to?
Sorry.
Maybe we already 45 minutes. Maybe we give you an additional 5 minutes for you to wrap up. And I think this is an excellent thing to have in the discussion. So that.
Yeah.
Sorry to.
Okay. So just to drive the point home. So the fourth magnon gets eaten up by the continuum. The bottom three get swashed into a flat mode, and then as you lower the field and the continuum comes down, then everything blurs into a broad continuum. Okay. That's the phenomenological picture that we see experimentally. So this is zero field data now. You see broad continuum everywhere with some intensity modulations, but say doing a scan up in energy, this red line would show you the scattering. There's no sharp modes in it. As soon as we apply a field, 0.21 Tesla, a sharp mode is visible at low energies. But really, all of the scattering, which extends up to several multiples of the strongest exchange, is genuine magnetic scattering. This is the level at which we know the background level. So this is really genuine magnetic scattering.
From the trend of basically your bands as a function of field, how small would you expect the gap to be at zero field?
OK, I'll come back to that. So this is just a summary. So a high field, we see sharp modes, well explained by this Hamiltonian. Then if we go to low field, you see the same Hamiltonian would predict sharp modes that disperse, whereas all we see experimentally is this broad scattering continuum. So the spinner picture somehow breaks down at intermediate to low field quite spectacularly. Now, to probe the very low energy scattering that's outside the neutron window, we've done specific heat measurements. Here is the zero field data to show the onset of counted ferromagnetism. Then if we now apply essentially a very small field, like 0.1 Tesla, you see this sharp blue mode is suppressed very, very rapidly. A 0.1 Tesla is almost not there anymore. At the same time, there's a broad maximum that develops at some higher temperatures, and this moves up to, in field, to higher temperatures. So if we take the position of the sharp peak and plot it on a phase diagram, then we get a phase boundary that's almost vertical and stops. So we didn't expect this necessarily initially, but can be rationalized by the fact that if you apply a magnetic field along the direction of which the system would pick a spontaneous ferromagnetic polarization, you've already made the choice for the system. There's no need to have a phase transition. This phase of finite field and the paramagnetic phase up here have the same symmetry. And you would only expect this phase to survive for a finite field range if the transition is first order. And indeed, it is first order here. And we think that this is consistent with our measurements. So the implication is that actually going up in field, there isn't a phase transition, but just a crossover. You increase the polarization, and you would increase the gap. And that's consistent with the measurements as well, because the specific heat done at progressively higher field show a suppression of weight at low temperatures and moving of weight to high temperatures. So that's the same as, but well, that's consistent with the gap increasing in field. So if we parameterize the rising part of the specific heat with a two-level system, then we obtain these red fits up here. Now, at very low temperatures, there's contributions from hyperfine coupling, so we remove that. At high temperatures, we know in neutron scattering there's lots of states there. But if we are at temperatures that are sufficiently small than the gap, you know, this parameterization is good at the qualitative level to get the trend. And if we use all these fits, then we get a gap that increases monotonically in field. So that, again, is consistent in our picture that there's just a crossover between the low field and a field polarized state. So just to summarize, we've seen that the gap increases monotonically in applied field. We've seen evidence for quantum fluctuations at all fields. At high fields, we identify that in the form of two magnons. There's quite interesting effects with magnons decaying, renormalization of dispersion at intermediate fields. And at very low fields, we see just broad scattering continue. Now, the parameterization that we've determined from an extensive data set of everything that's published, basically, we conclude that the system is far away from the Ising limit with dominant Jz, but actually has a dominant Jz plus minus term in this basis, which put the system very close to this phase boundary between ferromagnetism and antiferromagnetism. Now, if I just may, I'd like to show some of the open questions. So it'll be nice to do some calculation to try and parameterize or capture really the interaction between one and two particle states and understand this very strong renormalization. Also, the flat mode is very puzzling. And of course, phenomenologically, we think that it's some sort of excitation that's more localized, but it would be nice to put that on a firmer basis. And as Andre pointed out earlier, if the gap is very small, then indeed the spin wave theory picture would predict that at low field, we don't have just two magnons, but it's three magnons, and all these multi-magnons continua come and overlap over the same energy range. So is it even meaningful in that sense to try and describe this in terms of starting with magnons? And possibly there may be another simpler physical picture of the continuum. We're certainly looking for suggestions here. So the other point you might ask is, how is this proximity to the phase boundary relevant to the dynamics? Can that be used in some quantitative way to make predictions? And the Hamiltonian that we've identified, this Kitaev gamma model, actually hasn't been solved at the quantum level for the pyrochloride lattice. And we think it's very interesting because the pure Kitaev model actually sits at the phase boundary between ferromagnetism and antiferromagnetism. It's not a spin liquid, but it's on that phase boundary. And the gamma minus 1 is this point up here, which is some sort of classical spin liquid. And so we are very close to this phase boundary, which would have enhanced fluctuation. The other brief point that I want to mention is that it was very surprising to me first to identify Kitaev interactions in this Hamiltonian. Because Kitaev interactions have been proposed in really a pioneering paper by Giacchelli and Kaliulin in a very specific context of having J a half doublet, which is sort of spherically or has cubic symmetry, and then you have two octahedra edge sharing with 90 degrees bonds iridium, oxygen, iridium. And that gives rise to a leading order twin exchange that has a preferential direction perpendicular to this plane. Now, of course, here we don't have the J a half, but we have some other key ingredients which may be relevant in the sense that we have a doublet, a Kramer's doublet, but the wave functions are very different, but we also have the two oxygen exchange paths, and interference through these two exchange paths may be relevant. And another difference is that here, the Ising axis is perpendicular to this plane, whereas here, it's in the plane. Okay. So, it will be interesting to try and understand this, theoretically, and maybe from our initial calculations, whether one could have Kitaev interactions more widely occurring than initially thought. Yeah, thank you very much.
So maybe I go back to Una since I interrupted you when you asked your questions.
Can you do you, without having done the same exercise with other materials, but is there a reason to believe that other thought to be spinized materials would have the same thing happening?
I don't know. I mean, I think one would need to do very detailed experiments, and I think that going to high field is very informative. So I would say that this strategy of taking the system away from the strongly fluctuating limit and so on, and taking it into a regime where quantum fluctuations are entirely quenched, where there's no question about which theory is relevant, and then understanding the Hamiltonian, and then probing how the excitations evolve to low field, where fluctuations and frustration effects become more relevant, I think that's a very useful strategy. That strategy hasn't been applied to several of our other candidate materials, but it will be interesting to do so. Yes?
Did anyone look into two magnet bound states at high fields? Technical or experimental?
We didn't, and I don't know, maybe. I'm not aware of any such study. I think it will be interesting. I think experimentally we've established that you have to include magnon interactions, even at intermediate fields. So maybe there's richer physics to do with that, and certainly these effects will be interesting to look into.
I don't think I've ever seen a 2D plot like the pinch points for the spin ice. Do you have special features of this scattering?
So in this material, you can't see that because it's not spin ice.
No, but I mean, spin ice is an example. Sorry.
But in holmium titanate, it looks like this.
Yeah, so that was able to characterize the broad features by which the spin point. I'm wondering if in this case there are features that would characterize this continuum of scattering at the low energy.
So there are some rods of scattering that are seen at some elevated temperatures.
Rods of scattering.
Rods of scattering, that's right. And these could be explained by Monte Carlo calculations for a Hamiltonian that's very close to what we propose. There, the proximity to the phase boundary has been proposed to be relevant. So the proposal is that as long as you're close enough to that phase boundary, if you move along it, you would see these features. But they're not a feature of the spin of spinors.
Right.
Yeah, it's very different. Yes.
The question maybe it's a bit more philosophical, but you guys are feeding the data at high field, mm-hmm. and then you're trying to extrapolate those parameters to what you believe happens at zero field. But I mean, if I add additional exchange terms or I don't know bi-quadratic terms. Couldn't I be able to fit that high field using a different, not restricted to that Hamiltonian that you're looking at, the additional terms that are allowed by symmetry, and equally is not going to work at zero field, but it's going to give a different phase diagram? In other words, why should we believe that that particular set of exchange, you know, is all that we need to describe the system at zero field?
And even at high fields.
Huh?
And even at high fields.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
are probably the same. They're field independent. Parameters are probably the same. They're field independent. The question is how many of them.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you know that it doesn't work at low field, but then if I put more parameters and I get different parameters that also fit the high field, I know it's a bit philosophical, but I want to
okay,
understand.
So
there are only so many parameters. There's no bi-quadratic term because it's just in half.
At the nearest neighbor level, this is the Hamiltonian.
You have to only go to second neighbor or third neighbor. That's the only option.
One could go to further neighbors, but you know, our point of view is that we put as many parameters as are needed to explain the data, but no more.
I understand. So, that's the minimum. The problem
because you have to see a specific feature in the data to say you need this term to explain that that feature. Of course, we can add second neighbor terms, but they're not needed to explain. I mean, the data is already explainable.
No, I understand that the high field it's enough, but it only works for high field. So I wonder whether.
Okay. So there is one cross-check that we have done, which is to say that this is 9 Tesla, and this is 5 Tesla.
Okay.
So there's almost a factor 2 difference in field, and the same Hamiltonian works. Okay. If there was a change. You know, you would expect that you'd somehow be sensitive to that.
But on the nearest neighbor, I mean, from symmetry, because the pseudo spins, no other terms are allowed.
This is everything, the nearest neighbor.
Yeah.
So Radu didn't change the Hamiltonian, he's finding the parameters have to.
What I'm trying to say is that it doesn't work at low field, so.
Because there are no features.
So it doesn't work because we do not understand how to solve that Hamiltonian. It's a limitation of our understanding, not a limitation of.
Linear spin waves are not enough. Then basically you need to do much more advanced calculus.
I mean, I think from the phenomenon, forget modeling. Just the fact that we see that the magnons disappear into the continuum. And the dispersions get renormalized even before the continuum has hit them. I think this is purely empirical evidence that a linear order spinor theory will not work.
Okay.
There's strong coupling, so one spin flip is coupled with two. Forget about all the parameterization we've done, going to town with 500 points and whatever. Forget that. Just looking at this, you cannot explain it at the linear spin wave level. Purely phenomenological, yeah.
Another silly question, I guess. Is it surprising that the phase boundary between paramagnetism and your canted ferromagnetic state is independent of field, as in the temperature doesn't change, even though your gaps change quite strongly with field?
So if this transition was continuous, it would be a single point. It will be the same as, a ferromagnet in field. The transition is an isolated critical point. In an antiferromagnet, there will be a phase boundary, but in a ferromagnet, it's an isolated point. We think that this is just an extension of that physics, but because the transition is to six domains, it makes it first order. So then it can survive over some range of field. I mean, to within, you know, our accuracy, it doesn't seem to shift much. But I think certainly the general phenomenology, I think, can be rationalized by the symmetry argument.
Any chance of people doing the MRG on something like this, or is this considered because of the three dimensions and the simply two largest systems?
I don't know. I mean, it will be interesting to explore this further. I'm aware that the technique has been extended to 2D systems that are put on a cylinder, and then if you choose the boundary conditions right, then you can get some cuts along two dimensions in the 2D Brillouin zone that are the right ones that are representative of the full 2D picture, like a carbon nanotube warping. Now, if that could be possible in this case, you know, it's really beyond my understanding.
Even somewhat controversial still in the 2D case.
Yeah, but I think certainly, you know, it would be interesting to use the wide range of theoretical models, the quantum, to solve quantum problems, to attack this, I think.
Okay, so thank you very much for this very interesting talk.